Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Medicine on Call. This morning I have a special guest with me. His name is Dr. John Hunt, and we know each other from Liberty HealthShare. That's how we were introduced. But, you know, I wanted to have Dr. Hunt on because he's an author. He is a renowned academic physician, and he does some really yeoman's work and quality work in Africa. And I wanted to get a different opinion. Excuse me. I talk a lot on the show about the changing of medicine from the physician's standpoint. And I came at it from residency into working for a big independent group. And as soon as my contract was up, I ran to private practice. So I really have not had the experience of what it's like to be an academic physician throughout my career. And I think from what I've experienced from my interactions of being a consult in hospital settings and the changes that have gone on, I couldn't imagine what it must be like to actually have to be in that system, because I worked as a contract doctor so I could come and go as I pleased, and if I didn't like it, I wouldn't come back. But I've seen the changes from an outside point of view, and it seems to have gotten harder and harder to keep your sanity, to practice medicine with patient-centered medicine, where you're the advocate and you don't have to answer to anybody else except the patient. And I wanted Dr. Hunt to come on because he's worn these hats, and his career has changed. He's made decisions that have affected him, I'm sure now for the positive, but I wanted an insider point of view of what it was like when you first started in academic medicine. Why did you leave it? Did you love it initially? I want to tease your brain, essentially, so people can get a feeling for the other aspects of healthcare and what it's like to be a doctor in the system. I want to thank Dr. Hunt. Thank you for coming on to the show today, and I look forward to our conversation.
As do I. Thank you for having me on, Elena.
Let's start off a little bit about you.
About me? Oh, I don't like talking about me.
You have to talk about me today.
I'm a pediatrician, pediatric pulmonologist, allergist, immunologist. I did my medical school at George Washington University after graduating from Amherst College, and then I went off to the Navy. I was active duty for 6 years, 3 years of which were in Keflavik, Iceland. Left the Navy active duty, sailing on the reserves for a while. I came to the University of Virginia, where I began my reinserted myself into academia for the next roughly 15 years. And I left the University of Virginia about 2 years ago. They gave me tenure, and then I quit.
Hey, John, are you on a cell phone, or can you speak up a little louder? You're kind of going in and out.
Oh, no. Let me see if I can do it this way. Can you hear me better now?
That's better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very sorry about that.
No problem.
I am. Did you need me to repeat some of that material?
Yes, if you'd be so kind.
Okay, I'm so sorry. So Amherst College, George Washington University School of Medicine after that, and 6 years active duty in the Navy, pediatrics, pediatric pulmonology, allergy, immunology fellowships, and University of Virginia for about 15 years, where I ended up being a tenured associate professor, and I resigned from that position about 2 years ago, although I'd kind of gone part-time for a while prior to that. And now I do a whole bunch of other things that involve very little practice of medicine and essentially none in the United States.
See, that's the thing that really people need to understand. If you really still wanted to practice medicine in the academic setting, and I should ask you that question, but here you are, someone who has something major to offer our healthcare system, and you've been run out of it, essentially. I mean, am I taking this, is that how it happened? Or tell us let's start at the end and then work backwards. What made you finally leave American academic medicine?
Well, it has to do with my desire to be a moral human being among all else. Academic medicine, if I can give perspective on it, when I joined the University of Virginia in 1998, and for the next probably 8 years or so, it was really fantastic for me. My colleagues were and are still, to this day, there, just superb individual people, intellectually brilliant, and the and the whole situation for me was intellectually exciting. We were cutting edge, doing stuff that helped people, helped patients, and the academic world involves, you know, three primary things for a physician. It's clinical care, research, and teaching. And when I joined UVA, the faculty, which provides the primary parts of the care, clinical care, plus focuses on research and does all the teaching, the faculty in medical school, nursing school, and the other schools that were involved in healthcare were the center of things. And basically, we, not to be prima donna about it, but we had earned the privilege of being kind of in charge of ourselves and the work we chose to do, because we were the nexus of the teaching and the clinical and the research. But around 8 years ago or so, there was a gradual, actually a rather rapid shift over about a year or two from the faculty being kind of the focus to the administration being the focus. And I saw it coming, a few other people saw it as it happened. To me, it had been in the past, prior to this change, the faculty were there at the core. The division heads worked for the faculty. The department heads worked for the division heads. The dean worked for the department heads. And the president of the university worked for the deans. That's how it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a sudden shift over a year or so in which all of a sudden faculty worked for the division head, it worked for the department head, it worked for the dean, they did everything the president of the university told them to do. It became a command and control top-down process, which is, you know, something that's gone on throughout the United States of late.
Mm-hmm.
It's just we converted from an individual society to top-down command and control. And I tolerated it for as long as I could, and then I said, enough of that, and off I went.
Now, when you say it's run by the president, was that a physician or not? Just curious.
Oh, no.
Obviously,
oh,
okay.
No. I mean, the president's, one of the things that really got me out was when the president of the university decided that the number one goal of the medical center would have to be quality improvement initiatives. And this is dictated from on high. And, you know, it's one of those Obamacare things dropped mm-hmm. down through the relatively progressive university academics administrative structure.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, quality programs, I mean, they work great for Toyota transmissions when you're trying to make everything exactly identical. They work really well for that, but they don't work well for people at all and patients at all. It's just a big mess and really a giant joke. And when that became the number one purpose of the medical center as a top-down commandment with no real feedback from the faculty, it wasn't the last straw, but it certainly did raise my ire.
What was the morale? I mean, I know yours, you stepped up and you took care of business for yourself, but when you left, what was the morale of your colleagues?
Well, you know, I have a little bit different personality structure. My colleagues are brilliant and focused on their work, and they basically try to keep on going despite the problems from, you know, that arise from administrative diktat. They're better at it than I am, and they're better at tolerating it. They're better at working within it and despite it,
mm-hmm.
where I just wasn't. My personality makeup wasn't allowing me to participate in that command-control economy of academics at the time. And I think that they still, there's a huge amount of what the nursing world calls moral distress, I think, in medicine. Doctors tend to call it burnout,
mm-hmm.
but moral distress is when they're told to do things and they have to do things that they know are wrong or that they think are wrong. Or work within a system that just doesn't make any sense and it causes psychological harm. And I think that that is pervasive in medicine in and outside of academics. And although my colleagues happen to be just amazing people who can deal with it, I wasn't so amazing.
Well, I mean, you hear the statistic of 400 doctors committing suicide a year. I've never seen or heard that statistic when I was in training or when I first went into practice. So to me, it seems like an advent of this moral distress that you described. And doctors aren't one of the types of professionals who whine. And I think you're describing what I've always said about our colleagues. You know, you just get it done. You see another 10 or 20 patients a day. You know, you get home at 10 or 11 o'clock at night. You do more because you have less to work with and you just get it done and you don't complain. But I think that your method of handling this if there were more of you out there, I don't believe that we'd be in this position that we're in right now. You know, who is the person to stand up and say, I'm not going to do this. This is against my moral fiber, and I'm not doing it. I'm stepping away, or I'm blowing the whistle on it. Is that, I mean, maybe because I'm an outsider on this, is that something that somebody could, you know, realistically do? Or is peer review the thing that really stops people from changing the system from within?
You know, I don't actually have any idea of the answer. It's what I had to do as an individual to maintain my feeling of integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can reach out to the extreme comparison and say that, you know, had the Nazis not obeyed their commands, you know, the commands from above, then we wouldn't have had those horrors. Now, obviously, it's not the same thing, but, you know, ideologically, you know, principally, it's the same. When you obey an order that is wrong, when you work in a system that is evil and destructive to our patients, that that kind of helps the system continue. And I couldn't do it myself. And that doesn't mean that all doctors working in the system are, you know, accomplishing evil. No, not at all. But they are going to be distressed internally if they think enough about it to realize what they're participating in and that it's not optimal for our patients. So that's one of those wonderful things that Liberty Healthshare helps me have hope, because it's outside of that system.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, there's some connections certainly, but it gives an opportunity to bust away from that system. And it actually gives me kind of hope that I might want to participate in the clinical practice of medicine in the United States again,
mm-hmm.
such a system as Liberty Healthshare could create for us.
It's all about knowing that there's an option, knowing there's an alternative that's viable. And I think we get such an onslaught of, there's only one way to do this. You have to be in insurance. You have to be in network. You have to have, you know, at this point in time, someone, you know, cover you, you know, pay for your practice or buy it out, because it's the pathway that seems to be the most efficient at keeping you open. But it's not the most efficient at keeping you sane, from what you described.
I think that's so right. We have been lied to over the years. There was a progressive agenda of getting health insurance for all, and mm-hmm. you know how they started, you know full well about this. They started using the term health care and health insurance interchangeably back and forth, and people got numb to it and started mm-hmm. equating them in one of the most ridiculously thoughtless concepts you can imagine. I mean, logically, how is health insurance related to health care? If anything, it's probably the biggest reason why health care is so darn expensive these days.
You're absolutely right. You know,
we accepted these lies, Dr. George. Well, I mean, not we, but you know, some of the people out there, many of them, just accepted the notion that health care and health insurance are the same, and they find ways to justify these foolishnesses in their mind in order to occlude or block their own moral distress. You know, those defensiveness and denials of the alcoholic that the progressives will use to block their recognition of their own internal contradictions.
Look, on that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're speaking with Dr. John Hunt, author, physician, and I would say philanthropist at this point, because what you do in Africa is really helping humanity. But before we get to what you're doing now, I wanted to touch back again to the concept of moral hazard or moral indecision. You know, I feel like you do. You know, if you're unhappy with something, instead of being in the muck and mire of it and not colluding, but, you know, silence is complicit, in my opinion. If you help a system by making it money, by producing the type of medicine that keeps it going, then you're part of the problem. I'm a purist, and I can say that because I'm outside of it. So I make apologies to your colleagues, not to offend them. But this is doctors across the country. And I read your book, Assume the Physician, which I look is really awesome. And there's a paragraph in here, and I want to read that because I think that distills down what we're both talking about. It says, they're sheep. The doctors are so stuck in their asinine paradigms that they really sort of believe it's unethical to be paid by patients for work performed. They won't know how to compete. They're completely paralyzed. It's almost like the same system over us, where people are using or depending on the government to help them, being stuck in social services, it's kind of the same mentality. They're afraid to be solo practitioners, hang out a shingle, speak their mind, because they're going to get something taken away. Is that the crux of the problem? It's fear that's driving this?
Yeah, fear and this dedication. And actually, can you hear my voice?
Yeah, it's better. A little better.
This dedication to their noble pursuit, to our noble pursuit of health care for our patients, that prevents us from having the time to think it through. By us, I'm generalizing, but to think it through and to say, you know, what's the big picture here? What's going on? And then doing the things necessary to resolve it and fix it and make it a more moral system. The doctors are worked way too many hours and they're exhausted and you know, that's obviously clear in all the data out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's fear. And a lot of them are, you know, they don't want to take the risk of losing their income flow, which is, you know, usually pretty good for a doctor. And certainly when I left the practice of medicine in the U.S., my income flow dried up. But, you know, it's something that doctors are, you know, they're a little bit enslaved to their income, as everyone is. They get their big house and or a small house, whatever it is, they have a mortgage to pay, and now they're stuck. Just like all the students are going to have, they're going to be stuck because of their huge student loans,
mm-hmm.
and you've got to keep on going.
Yeah.
So I think the thing is that there's moral distress, people doing what they think that they shouldn't be doing, but they don't feel like have a choice. There's moral hazard, which is also known as the third-party payer problem, where somebody else is paying for the decisions that a doctor and a patient make together. And as soon as that happens, prices go flying through the roof. And that's what's caused our problem, in my opinion, in our country,
mm-hmm.
in healthcare, is that the third-party decision-makers, or the third party has had to move in to the first and second party. The first party is the doc, the second party is the patient, third party is insurance or the government. They've had the third party is like seeing these bills go higher and higher and higher because the first and second party aren't getting adversely impacted by the cost of their decisions. The third party comes in and says, I've got to control this cost, so they come in and take over the decision-making from the doctor and the patient as their way to counter the price hyperinflation. And thus, doctors and patients no longer are able to make all the decisions that they should be making. Of course, the insurance, the people who promote health insurance for all just make the whole moral hazard problem worse. When you get effective Medicare for all or socialized medicine, the only way to make that work is if the third party, the government or insurance, makes all the decisions for the patient and the doctor. And that's the people who are trying to shoot for that universal single-payer type of concept. What they're really shooting for is for the third party to be making the medical decisions. Otherwise, their system will not work financially.
You know, I have to say, from what I've experienced and what I've read and what I've written about, it's not the doctor and the patient that cause the cost. It is the third party in the government with regulation, compliance, and their layer of insertion of them into the system. They're the cost drivers. And I was on an interview yesterday, and somebody called who was part of the insurance industry trying to say that, you know, the Affordable Care Act is a start and that was a good place to go. And my opinion was it doubled down on the worst aspects.
Yes,
now you have,
exactly.
You've gone from the doctor and patient making the fiduciary decision to that power being taken from the doctor, given to the hospital, where they can tack on as many administrative fees. There's no transparency. It's triple, or that's putting it mildly, sometimes 10 times what it costs to do it in your office. And you're not getting better care. You're waiting longer. You have the position of, you know, hospital acquired infections, et cetera. It's not a better system, but they made it. It's all media driven. You're right. They started off with health insurance equals quality health care. That was a problem. Now they're trying to say providers, you know, doctors are just part of the whole. We don't do anything different than a nurse practitioner or physician assistant. Is that something, too, the fact that doctors are now not on the, mostly are moving to be not on the front line, and we have mid-level practitioners who don't train the same way as being
I think that's all part of the method that the third-party payers are using to combat the third-party payer problem or the moral hazard, where instead of the doctors and patients knowing what things cost at the ground floor, you know, right at the grassroots, and the patient saying, you know, this is more than I want to pay, and or a patient even asking, how much is this going to cost, mm-hmm. which rarely happens. And often, more often than not, doctors don't know how much something is going to cost. So there's no shopping around, there's no price competition to bring prices down, because the patient doesn't usually care because of the third-party payer. So the third-party payer has to care about the cost, and they come up with all kinds of ways to control those decisions being made by the patients and the doctors. And that's where I think all the problem is, and why we're so frustrated is because, as doctors, is because we have not been wise enough as a profession to know how much our services should be priced, how much they should cost, to know the prices and be able to tell our patients what things cost, try to save our patients money. Doctors used to try to save our patients money. I mean, we're not like auto mechanics dealing with somebody who's got a car that's, you know, dead on the side of the road and we might charge them just about anything. We as doctors are trying to help our patients save money and be healthy, because we generally are a noble soul. So I think that part of it is regulations and insertion. Certainly the government subsidizing health insurance for so long and now compelling health insurance, which is the problem. You know, the insurance is the problem, not the solution. All that's a huge problem. The regulations, FDA is a disaster. I mean, huge expenses, totally unnecessary. Lots and lots of people, millions maybe, who've died from delayed approval of eventually approved drugs. Huge problems, government getting involved in healthcare.
It's, you know, it's not just the government. It's the public-private partnership of the government. It's the revolving door from FDA people into pharmaceuticals and vice versa. So there's always someone with a crony interest in this. You know, someone stands to gain. It's never about the doctor and patient. It's about how the layer above can gouge the system. And we see that the FDA, former head of FDA is being, I don't know if she's being indicted, but just charges are being brought against her for having her husband's, I think he's a hedge fund person, and her pushing some drug that he's going to benefit from. I mean, this is, and nobody goes to jail. This is a problem, you know? Why should it cost billions of dollars for an FDA drug to get approved? And I just, you're right, the whole system is broken, just like the political system is. If a supplement does the same thing as a pharmaceutical, a big pharma, but they want to get a patent on, say, vitamin D, I'm sure they're going to try something crazy where they take something that's natural and try to patent it, make a synthetic version, patent it, and then make the supplement illegal so there'll be no competition. They can jack up the price. This is how it works, isn't it?
Oh, my. It's the depth and brilliance of large pharma marketing people is amazing. So you give some examples. There's a lot more devious use of the collectivism that has taken over this country and Europe out there in large pharma. And, you know, one of the examples I like to give is, I won't use the name of the drugs so they'll probably sue me, but one of the largest pharmaceutical companies had a drug for asthma that was not a great drug, but everyone thought it was great, and they marketed it the gazoo out of it. And then they did this enormous 30,000-patient study of COPD, the same asthma drug. It's actually a combination drug, and they did their study for COPD mm-hmm. and found that in COPD, in a 30,000-patient study, that there was a minor statistical benefit to the drug. And they managed to get a good chunk of Europe to make sure that every patient with COPD gets on their drug. The reality of it is that probably about 7% of the patients with COPD got better on their drug, and those patients with COPD also had asthma. But they did this 30,000-patient study quite knowingly that if they did that, that 7% would have enough of an impact to show a statistically significant effect. And they used that to convince the governments to start paying for their drug for COPD. And yet 93% of patients taking that don't get any benefit. That's the kind of bogus stuff that these marketing people at large pharma will try to pull off. And they do it successfully because we've taken evidence-based medicine as some kind of new standard that we're supposed to abide by, when really it's just an opportunity for large pharma to mess around and manipulate the third party payment system into giving them larger profits.
It's amazing. It's a house of cards, though, if we take our power back. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're talking with Dr. John Hunt. And before the break, John, we made a couple analogies, and there's a bigger picture here. It's all about changing out the workforce into the corporate system. Everybody who employs somebody, they're trying to get a cheaper iteration of the worker. That's why we have a lot of immigrants flowing in my opinion. That's what's happening with medicine and having a switch over from doctors to mid-level practitioners. Now, I just read an article yesterday where 45% of the truckers in our country are now foreign-born. They're not American citizens. Well, I mean, I guess some of them become citizens, I suppose, at this point. But the point is that the trucking force has changed because they're cheaper. So this is what's happening. They want to maximize profits. Healthcare is a sixth of the economy. What better way to do it and help your friends who help craft the bill than to make it easy for them to have complete access with no competition? You know, it makes sense if you think about it from a business perspective, but from a human perspective, it's not very good at all.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it from a crony business perspective, mm-hmm. it makes sense. But if it was a free market capitalist system where the cronyism was illegal, not allowed, or where the cronyism requires political power, and if you minimize the political power, minimize the power of the politicians, cronyism fades away.
Mm-hmm.
And cronyism, which I think that, you know, the Bernie supporters probably should be more against cronyism than anything else, and they are. They just don't connect in and say, gee, cronyism results from political power. And so their solution to cronyism seems to be to expand political power, which
exactly.
is one of those internal contradictions which leads them to have to, you know, use denial, defensiveness, and insults in order to protect their ego from seeing their internal contradictions.
That's an excellent point. I mean, if they won this argument and got what they wanted, we would have an absolute control grid where the corporation and the public-private partnerships and the whatever crony relationship that exists would be on steroids. I mean,
right.
You couldn't do anything.
Bernie is cronyism on steroids.
Yeah.
Even as he speaks strongly against the cronyism of Wall Street, his system makes for cronyism. It's what it does.
Well, it's not really very well thought out. It's more emotion driven. And that's where we are right now, where language really does mean something. You know, I used to have the opinion that sticks and stones will break your bones, words can't hurt you. But that's not true. They are using language in a way that's a weapon. We're providers instead of doctors. You know, you can hurt somebody, you know, you trigger them with what you say. It's it's like a physical assault now. I mean, anybody can be offended by anything all of a sudden, and it's all about changing the wording, changing the meaning of what something means, because you say it means something different. And I think for us as physicians, we need to take our power back as healers. And from a standpoint from the hospital setting, you mentioned, I mean, we talk in generalities about how this is bad for patients, but can you give us an example so they can, my listeners can really get their teeth into what makes it bad for the patient in this system exactly?
Well, I think it all revolves around the loss of control of their own decisions and the loss of access to the wonderful opportunities that a free market could provide. And, you know, just a brief aside, we have no free market in medicine as a system in this country. It's not like the last 30 or 50 years have been free market medicine that's failed. Not at all. It's been crony medicine gradually increasing. End of aside. But anyhow, when you have a system where the only way to control the hyperinflating costs is by having the command and control top-down dictation of everything, including your individual personal health care choices, we are left with a very bad problem. And that, I think, will affect everybody. When they sit down with their doctor and the doctor says, we need to get a chest x-ray, but it's going to cost you, you know, $490. Now, a chest x-ray these days should cost about $16.
Mm-hmm.
And a blood count should cost about $3. The better and more efficient technology that comes from high tech in every other sector of the economy has brought down costs enormously. So the stuff that only the rich could afford or get afforded by the poor, like an iPhone or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But in healthcare, the high tech has not brought down costs because of the third-party payment problem, in my opinion, because somebody else was paying for them. So we are left with a situation where someone who doesn't have insurance comes into the doctor, wants to need some work done, and it costs them $1,000 when it should have cost them $70. Because it costs $1,000, they say, holy cow, I should have had insurance. And so they go out and get insurance. The insurance company then serves to negotiate, does actually provide a value in negotiating down the hyperinflated charge that the doctor or hospital charges to something a little bit more reasonable. But in order to get that negotiation service, the patient has had to give up a fair amount of their decision making. And that is an ongoing, increasing process that bit by bit, the price is so high that you can't afford anything without insurance, so you have to get insurance, which makes the price higher, you know, and you get this horrible, vicious cycle.
You know, but from a standpoint, from an independent physician standpoint, they don't bring the price down. They don't negotiate a discount for the patient. They just charge the patient in premiums and co-pays and deductibles, and they undervalue our services. That's why doctors are leaving the practice of medicine, or I should say, at least private practice, and taking jobs in a hospital setting where they're going to be a salaried professional. Because it's not right. They're literally pocketing money from both sides. They screw the doctor over by not paying us what our value is in our service. They take it from the patient out of their pocket, and they keep a difference. You know how long it takes to get paid for a claim? I've over a year in some instances. They've gotten the, what do you call it, from the banks, their, whatever, I'm drawing a blank on what it's called, but they're making money from the bank, taking their time paying us. So they're making hand over fist money. They're not suffering at all. They're not adding any service, in my opinion, value to this system that wasn't already there inherent in the doctor-patient relationship. If you couldn't afford my service, we'd make a deal. It still happens. Right?
Right, and that's what it's supposed to be, is that the doctor and patient, they're a particularly noble relationship, a good relationship that we care for each other's outcome. That's the way it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think health insurance the service they provide to negotiate down hyperinflated prices is only because their existence created the hyperinflated prices in the first place. So, I mean, it's just like an extortion racket. We're going to destroy your store unless you pay us $1,000 a week to protect your store from us destroying it.
Yeah.
Oh, which is kind of like the IRS, by the way.
But it's also like, it's racketeering too. I mean, they should actually, they can pick up some RICO charges on a lot of folks in this healthcare system because it's collusion,
sure.
It's racketeering, it's bullying, it's you name it. And we're the front of it. It's supposed to always work for the doctor and patient. That's what the Affordable Care Act was supposed to do. It works against both of us, and it's empowered these very interests that have been gouging the system and making it worse. And now they've got full power, total control. And, you know, for those, do you think that the Affordable Care Act is a Trojan horse for single payer? Or do you think it's, what's your opinion, I guess?
I really don't think the people who crafted it were intellectually competent enough to make a perfect Trojan horse. I think that instead they did their darndest to do something they should never have tried to do, you know, plan and control large sections of the economy. They were narcissistic as all get out, and narcissism is often associated with utter incompetence and failure, and I think that's where the ACA ended up being just a horrible narcissistic notion. But some people justify it and saying, well, it's gonna collapse and burn, and therefore we'll do something like Medicare for all.
That's a disaster.
Which, again, it can control costs. It is an effective
but way it
of
doesn't.
Not now.
Medicare is going, oh my gosh. Well, this is, again, I had a guest on my show who specializes in helping seniors navigate the Medicare system. And the way he described it, you've got so many contractors, so many people gouging the system, and their whole job, some of them, is just to recover money. Just that's all they do, but you have to pay them for that. So the government is wasting money on the infrastructure. It's not going to the doctors. We're not the reason that they're losing money. It's because of all these other layers that they're trying to do to command and control. It's not a system that works well. Imagine throwing more millions of people into it. It's just going to be a slush fund for somebody while they deny care to the patient.
Yeah, I think that the Medicare for all concept, as I said, costs are out of control now. The only way it can control costs is because it's a step towards complete command and control, where no longer is there a whole lot of people figuring out how to game the system by maximizing the sequence of their CPT and ICD-9 codes on billing statements. No longer is that, because the government will simply say, you will work for us. We will pay for your medical school. You will work for us, and you will take our pay, and you will do exactly what we tell you. And if that person is, you know, not going to benefit significantly from some care, you're not going to give them that care, in our minds.
Ask the UK how that works. They're actually striking now because of that. The young doctors, the ones in training, emergency room physicians, you just described the system that they live under, and they're working them like dogs. They don't even have time with their family, and they wanted to lower their hourly fee or what they got paid, and they finally said no more, we're striking. So that's a huge problem. They'll get, whoever controls the pocketbook has the power. And if it's not the patient, then they're out of luck. And if the physician can't be party to with the patient, then they're out of luck too. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And you see where it goes. When I'm giving a talk in Poland a bunch of years ago, and it was to a Polish audience, and my Polish was rusty. So I had a translator, and my translator was a pediatric surgeon, and she did work as a translator because she got paid substantially better as a translator than she did as a pediatric surgeon.
Isn't that crazy?
And the Polish doctors had gone on strike some years earlier because of the same things you just described in the UK. And the media and the people turned against them and declared them selfish and said that they have no right to do this. There's a social contract that they have to abide by because they signed the Hippocratic Oath or swore the Hippocratic Oath, and they have to abide by it and take care of people. So, they, you know, the progressive side of the world tries to, you know, guilt people into doing what they are told to do. And, I don't know, strikes, I'm all in favor of it, whether they'll work or not, I don't know.
Well, you know, I think the answer to somebody who tells you that is, you don't have the right to make me euthanize my patient, deny them care. Is that what you're talking about? That's against my Hippocratic Oath. You don't run my show. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. You know, I'm having a really good conversation with Dr. John Hunt. And Dr. Hunt, in the last few minutes, we talked about what the problem is. And I want to talk about your solution. You're doing a lot of things that are outside of medicine, and you are going to come back and practice, which is good for us. But what's been going on in your life that's made you whole again and centered you?
Well, so there's things I'd like to do to improve the practice of medicine and to fix the society, but it's not things that would be my plan. It's just get other people to stop planning for other people and just, you know, let people figure it out for themselves and basically get government out of the way, get the cronies out of the way. That's the large societal thing that I'd love to see happen. But as far as an individual and, you know, what did I do? The first thing I did was I escaped out of the system that I thought was oppressing our patients and oppressing our profession, not participate in it. And I think it was Paul Rosenberg who modified a previous quote that was attributed to Lord Acton when he said, the only thing necessary for evil to succeed is for good men to obey. And so I just stopped obeying. Mm-hmm. And that made me feel great. All of a sudden, I didn't have these conflicts. I now significantly participate in running a transportation company in town, buses and limousines and cars that drive people around. It has nothing to do with medicine, but it's almost completely unregulated, and it's very refreshing. With my life partner, Kimberly Ann Johnson, we started a foundation in West Africa, in Liberia specifically, to provide support for education for women. That then expanded on to orphanages, solar panels for orphanages, food, mattresses, wells, et cetera, for orphanages, and now does college scholarships for the same young women who we sponsored through their high school education, which is where our focus is now. That organization called Trusted Angels Foundation has had an offspring in a way called Partners Liberia, which is some people who went over with us initially who, in the most typical libertarian way, were keeping organizations small. So they've morphed into another smaller organization, which is very active in trying to help war-torn Liberia to resuscitate itself.
Mm-hmm. That's key.
That has been extremely refreshing, that sort of work with Kimmy Johnson.
Well, how do you bring that zeal and that love back here? What's your plan to make a spark here as well?
Yeah, I think that the biggest impact I hope to have is to continue to work with Liberty HealthShare, which again just brings a big smile to my face because it is this hope that I have to re-empower the doctor-patient relationship. Liberty HealthShare has created a system that is outside of the Obamacare and outside the prior dysfunctional system. As Buckminster Fuller says, if you have a broken system, don't try to fix it. Build a new system and the good people will come to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how I would like to spend my mental energies, is to help Liberty HealthShare to bring their system of healthcare sharing to as many people as possible, to provide for them an honorable, moral, and economically functional way of protecting their finances and getting the full access to their health care choices that they want to be, that they should be making on their own, as opposed to having other forces make the decisions for them. So Liberty Healthcare basically has a good impact on fighting against the moral hazard that has cost us all in the healthcare profession so dearly, patients, physicians alike.
And I think from the standpoint of our colleagues, if they see an alternate system thrive, it allows them the freedom and the, you know, decreases the anxiety about making a change themselves, I hope. You know, it's like you build it and they'll come.
Right. Yes, if we build it, they will come. And good people will come to a good system, and good people will leave the bad system. But it takes some faith that it's okay to leave that bad system. Mm-hmm. You have a little bit of income somehow from some source that allow you to carry over and transfer to a new system. Now, that's the big concept of like quitting healthcare in the United States. Liberty Healthcare actually provides a nice way to transition without that risk, because Liberty Healthcare compensates physicians very adequately, way more than most insurance companies do, but it doesn't get involved in the decision-making process for the patients. So it has it's not like it's such a risk. I think doctors should very much consider signing on to Liberty Healthcare and provide services. Check it out, see how it works. Definitely different than insurance. Don't get confused.
Oh, it's awesome.
Liberty Healthcare tries not to reimburse physicians. It tries to compensate physicians.
I know. Isn't it? It's a mindset. It's a total mindset. You're not fighting for a pre-certification. You just send in your charge. You know,
yeah.
As long as it's medically necessary, then it gets covered. And even plastic surgeons, if they're doing cleft lip repair, if they're doing something reconstructive, that would also be covered. You know, so everybody, every specialty within our profession would actually benefit from moving outside the third-party paradigm, because it's getting harder in there. They're denying standard of care that's been around for 50 years. They won't cover allergy testing for us here in Georgia. So the allergy treatment is now experimental all of a sudden. So they're going backwards in time to do what they can to grasp their profits on the backs of everybody. It's not gotten better at all.
Well, with administration expenses and the size of the administration in medicine now expanding, you've seen the graphs where the size of the physician pool has expanded, you know, along an almost horizontal line, barely. And the size of the number of administrators has just taken off like Al Gore's hockey stick. And they have to pay for all those administrators who create no value in the system, produce no health care, and do nothing other than spend their time trying to justify their existence. They have to pay for all these people.
Well, the answer is to withdraw your consent. In the last couple minutes we have, how can people get your books and reach you if they want to?
So they can get my books at Amazon, Barnes & Noble are probably the easiest ways, right online. I have three books, two novels, and one other book out right now. The two novels are Higher Cause, which is not medical, and Assume the Physician, which is a medical satire, which we talked about at the beginning. The whole thing is funny all the way through, but it's poignant. It's really designed to teach what's going on in our healthcare system. A book published last fall called Your Child's Asthma, which is a parent's guide that I wrote to continue to provide some use of my education, which was very focused on pediatric lung disease. So that's available also, Your Child's Asthma. And I recommend that for parents and doctors, too, who want to have some kind of a highly subspecialized look at pediatric asthma.
And is there a way that people can support your foundation?
TrustedAngels.org. And it was named Trusted Angels because it came in initially as an entrepreneur, which I am, came in to do entrepreneurial support for small businesses trying to start up in Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that name came from. But but primarily now focused on education of primarily women. So trustedangels.org. Absolutely. It would be great to get support.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I learned a lot. I hope my listeners did too. I know they did, actually. And I look forward to having you again on.
Thank you so much for having me on. Great participating. Beef up the great work, please.
You too. God bless. Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.